Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was observing the two baby crows, whom she has nicknamed Yawp and Droopy. We resume with episode 3 of Suburban Safari on page 23. In spite of Yawp, I'm growing fond of my crows. I head into the yard every day with good intentions. I'll watch the ants. I'll study the trees. And the crows distract me. Yawp becomes a great fan of hopping. One day he spends 10 minutes hopping up onto the neighbor's birdbath, then hopping down again. Sometimes he hops straight up in the air and comes down facing a new direction. Whenever another crow pecks the ground, he bounds across the lawn in a series of gallopy hops. He bounces at starlings and pigeons, sending them whirring away. He hops at squirrels, who hop right back at him, swinging a paw. He picks up a green pear the size of a walnut and careens toward Droopy, holding it high. Droopy walks away from her brother. Yawp drops the pear and hops over her, landing in her path. Droopy's talents lie in another direction. She's a stick girl. In her spare time, she sits in an old apple tree and breaks off twigs. She toys with each for a few minutes, then drops it and chooses another. This can be a dangerous time to be friends with a crow. Someone has written to crow scholar Kevin McGowan's website about crows repeatedly peeling the rubber off their windshield wipers. Textbook juvenile behavior, McGowan replies. While young crows are extra pesky, crows of any age can be terrible teasers. Killam, author of The Crow Book, once watched a crow flaunting a piece of food to lure a wild turkey into chasing him. After a good romp across the field, the crow revealed his prize, a chunk of cow pie. Tee-hee! Killam writes that they are also tail pullers, yanking the tails of vultures and otters to make them abandon food. This I saw once myself, when a seagull was hogging peanuts I had spread for my crows. 4 crows circled the gull, and one in the back leaned forward to yank a tail feather. In a similar vein, I once watched 2 crows at my neighborhood beach mugging a seagull. The gull stood over a crab, with a crow posted 4 feet to either side. The gull seemed to fear that if he shook the crab apart, pieces might spin toward a crow. So he waited, clucking. The crab gathered its wits and walked away. The seagull snatched it back. The crows gazed out to sea as though butter wouldn't melt in their beaks. The seagull clucked louder. The crab again excused itself and was again dragged back. And then the seagull could stand it no longer and charged the right-hand crow. The left-hand crow flew away with the crab by the time the gull reconsidered. The 2 crows did not share. In mid-July, it's suddenly Droopy's turn to be annoying. One balmy morning, I step outside to the soprano racket of a crow losing her mind. From the depths of an apple tree comes a string of contradictions and pronouncements that add up to gibberish. By now, I am fluent in crow, and it sounds to me as though Droopy has suddenly learned to speak, but has no inkling what words mean. First comes a long caw, then immediately cut, 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 and then caw, caw, caw. If I may tender a translation, this means roughly, I'm Droopy and everything's fine. Horrors, a crow-eating devil. Hey, guys, I found food. I'm Droopy and here comes a demon. There's food here. At the end of a verse, Droopy flies to the neighbor's cherry tree and clambers around looking for fruit. She babbles on, caw, cut, cut, crack, crack, cut, 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 tuck, tuck. For weeks, she wakes the neighborhood at dawn with a string of witticisms she's thought up overnight. Her family learns to ignore her. They don't fly to investigate her announcements of feasts or friends. She chatters to herself as she hunts worms. When a member of the family down the block issues his routine sentry call, she tosses off a perfect imitation of him. Crows, like starlings, are fair mimics, even managing human speech. She attempts a series of super-quick caws but ends with a strangled cough. The girl even looks demented, with leftover baby down poking out through her feathers and a lump on her droopy shoulder. The whole family is molting and revolting. It's not just them. All the neighborhood birds are facing a change of feathers, which are designed to last through 1 year of flying, fighting, and bumping into things. With summer food plentiful and the demands of nesting past, birds can now afford to invest in fresh plumage. I find something new on the ground every day. Sapphire blue jay feathers, glossy crow feathers, salmon pink cardinal down. Flying with missing feathers demands extra calories, but the timing is not accidental. My yard is stuffed with food. The raspberries at the back are ripening. The catbirds, who live near there, toss back whole fruits. When I pick a few myself, Mr. Catbird greets me with what I like to think is a friendly tone. The wild grapes that drape the oak tree aren't ripe, but both catbirds and cardinals are harvesting them. Too big to swallow, the grapes have to be carried to the ground for butchering. This alarms me, given the number of cats that roam the neighborhood, so I keep watch while my comrades eat. Acorns are thudding down, too. Squirrels and blue jays tuck the nuts into the lawn, arranging the grass over them. Cut, cut, cut! Someone is at the top of a pear tree, yelling for the family. Soon, all six crows are crawling around the branches, jabbing unripe pears. Hard fruit thumps on the lawn. One by one, each crow skewers a hard pear, then flies to neighbor Hugh's house. I don't know what's so compelling about his roof, but they line up on it, each pecking a pear clasped in his or her feet. The occasional pear gets loose and rolls down the shingles. The crow either catches up with it or returns to the tree for another. The pears teach me something about animal appetites. Clearly, the crows love pears. At least twice a day, some of the clan gather to eat them. Two birds might climb in the branches, while two others peck the fruit that falls. But after an hour of pairing, they'll drift to worming or disappear toward the pizza joint at the end of my street. They like a varied diet. There are exceptions, of course, foods too precious to leave uneaten or uncached. Peanuts, I discover, are irresistible. One day I toss salted peanuts out onto the lawn when a crow is watching. The crow alerts the others. Cut, cut, cut! The family assembles in the trees, and when I retreat to the deck, they descend. After just a few of these peanutting sessions, the crows know the sound of peanuts rattling in the plastic jar. If I feel silly singing out, "Crow, crow," I can shake the jar to summon them. The first few times they approach the food cautiously, hopping at the peanuts, then leaping back as though they've landed on hot coals. I've read a similar account of ravens approaching an animal carcass in Bird Heinrich's Ravens in Winter. Heinrich speculated that these jumps help the bird confirm that the prey is really, truly dead, not lying in wait for ravens. In that light, it's pathetic to see the crows tiptoeing around as though my peanuts could rear up and bite them. When I run out of peanuts, I try the crows on old bread, past prime rib, and withering grapes. Novelty, though, is never amusing to a crow. Bread seems familiar to them, and they snatch it readily. But the old steak is so scary that they visit periodically all day, bouncing and retreating. A skunk or possum drags it away in the night. Grapes are taken after much leaping and alarm. Even after the crows have consumed many meals of freezer-burned chicken, a piece that lands standing upright on the lawn is disconcerting. Yawp circles the upright morsel for a full 5 minutes, crouching and feinting at it. He finally steals close enough to extend 1 foot and tip it over. Then it's safe to seize. Whenever the crows come to dine, they swallow a few bites and carry the rest away to stash for later. Peanuts they hold in the back of their throat and line up in their beak until they can't pick up one without dropping another. Saltines they pile 5 high on the ground, then lift in a stack. Chicken they shred and swallow until the main chunk is light enough to carry away. Loaded down, they flap off to cache. One might fly to a nearby pine, poking his peanuts between the branches. Another is partial to a tangle of dead sumacs in the south neighbor's bamboo wilderness. They often tuck their goodies into tufts of my lawn, rearranging the grass over the stash so adroitly that I can never find it. The only time I ever find a crow cache in the yard, it'll tickle the top of my head. Ducking under a sumac, I'll look up and see a strip of squirrel skin, a white bone protruding from the bottom, wedged into the sumac crotch. With the meals I've been serving, I'm not surprised they haven't come back for that. In this fat season, all the birds are in constant motion, and only a fraction of their busyness involves eating. They are forever on the lookout for predators. Mr. and Mrs. Catbird fly to the berry patch in stages, perching and scanning, before they flit into the canes. Then they grab a quick berry and return to a higher perch. They scan again before they toss back the fruit. They seem never to relax, and with good reason. One day a shredding sound comes through the open window. I glance out just in time to see a big bird blasting out of the lilac hedge. He has dived straight down on a gang of English sparrows. Empty-handed, he coasts up to the oak tree. He settles and looks around, his head swiveling over a ginger-speckled breast. With my bird book, I sit at the window and exercise my frustration. Bird books generally present 3 portraits of each bird: adult male, adult female, juvenile. But the things that fly into my line of sight seem to be transsexual, semi-mature birds blown 4,000 miles out of their normal range. Today, typically, Roger Torrey Peterson presents nothing that looks like my hunter. I call a birder friend who opens her Sibley. As the hunter scans the yard, we conclude that he could be a teenaged, sharp-shinned hawk. When the crows discover him, they hurtle toward him, braying. He lifts off, cutting around the trees. A minute later, he appears high in the sky. And as Peterson says a sharpie should, his silhouette goes flap, 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 glide. He's just a youngster, more brawn than brain. But he'll be back in my yard every week or so, and eventually I'll see him sink his talons into a meal. I'm soon confronted with another threat to my birds. On a wet day, when I go to pick berries, Mr. Catbird doesn't show up to mew at me. The little babbler, who spins off the songs of cardinals, seagulls, kiwis, and nitwits, is silent. Well, I think to myself, it's a chaotic time in the avian world. Kids are out and about, terrifying their parents with their ignorance. In some species, families are merging into crowds who travel the neighborhood in division strength. Territories, so hard won a few months ago, are disintegrating. Returning to the house, I note a gray breast feather in the damp grass. Molting, I think. Then I see a dark tail feather. I don't want to look for more. I make a methodical survey anyway. A downy feather and a gray wing feather lie near the deck. A big tail feather, broken and gritty, is near the street. I hope to salvage some peace of mind from the possibility that the Sharpie took my catbird. But this trail of feathers marks the highway that a half-dozen neighborhood cats take through my yard. I can imagine my catbird beating his wings against the cat and soil as he was carried away. Death by Sharpie I could have accepted. Hawks need to eat. But the cat had probably breakfasted on kitty kibbles. The cat probably killed my catbird solely at the urging of instinct. That's what I'll read later, along with a litany of additional sorrows. Bells are little help. Declawing is no cure. Overfeeding doesn't work. Cats are hardwired to hunt, whether they're hungry or not. And every year in the United States, they kill hundreds of millions, perhaps billions, of birds that are protected by federal law. Even birds that break free from cat claws risk a fatal infection. I'll learn this later. This morning, though, I'll stand under the sumac, out of sight of the neighbors, and drop my head in my hands. In my grief, I envision a day when my yard is silent, except for the meowing of other people's cats. I think about trapping the cats and tying notes to their collars for their owners to read. I think of calling the Justice Department to tell them that federal law bans the killing of catbirds, and to insist that every cat owner on the street be rounded up and questioned about this felony. The weather is gloomy, and that's my excuse for staying indoors the rest of the day. The truth is, the lawn feels like a grave. I wonder if it would help to gather up the feathers. I could bury them, or put them in a hole in the apple tree, or build miniature arrows from them to shoot at the cats. The following day in the yard, this ain't no lie, bird motion overhead catches my attention. Pecking tentatively at the ripening grapes is a new minted catbird, his tail and beak blunt with youth. When he flicks his tail, it's an abbreviated gesture. But he flicks it just the same, tilting his black eye to regard me. He flies to an apple tree and snatches a large insect. It's big enough that he has to toss it around to get it aimed down his throat. It squirms, then he swallows. His voice is young and tentative, but with an eye on me, he uses it. Mew. A better woman than I would mourn the murdered insect, now being crushed in the grit and muscle of the catbird's gizzard. But we choose what we love. I love my catbirds. Furthermore, I will risk the disdain of millions and confess that I am also coming to adore my crows. Later this summer, I'll hear of the first case of West Nile killing a crow in Maine. It will happen in my town, and I'll fret like a mother hen until I see all six of my crows together. This will take a tense 2 weeks, and I'll wonder if they're splitting up on purpose to yank my tail feathers. Chapter 2. Bugs in My Belfry. She's as winsome as a puppy. She's as dexterous as a cat. She's cute as a bug. She is a bug. The ladybug was hunting aphids on a bamboo leaf when I disrupted her with a tap. She turtled and rolled into my hand. I dropped her into a ceramic souffle cup and slid her underneath the lens. Unfortunately, I had earlier put a slug in this same dish, and I didn't rinse it well enough. Now, one of the ladybug's legs has been glopped with what looks like beaten egg. She lets me admire her undercarriage for a few minutes. Her black legs fold across her abdomen like armor, fitting inside the rim of her red wing covers. Then she unclasps a couple of appendages and paws the air for traction. I give her a stick, and she scrambles upright. She rests for a good 5 minutes. One blunt antenna twitches. A front leg spasms. I'm afraid she may be processing a stress chemical that swamped her when I caught her. After a few more minutes, she pulls it together. She lifts a front leg and rotates her black and white face toward it. To my surprise, she bites onto the upper leg and pulls the appendage through her maw, cleaning it. She rubs the leg over her head exactly as a cat would, then cleans it again in her mouth parts. She cleans the other front leg. The rear leg is now glued to her red shell with dry slug slime. She works it free, then scrapes it against the edge of her shell, a pair of specialized forewings, really, until the yellow stuff flakes off. Grooming complete, she marches up the stick, hoists her forewings, unfolds her flying wings, and blasts off. She bonks into the microscope lens and falls on the deck. On her second try, she whirs into the air and heads back to work. A slug, for the record, is also stunning under the microscope, a glistening caramel mound with a faintly striped mantle. Even the brown bullets that encase mosquito larvae are beautiful, viewed large. And though some of the creepy crawlies I slide under the microscope make me want to yelp and run away, I persevere in collecting my backyard bugs. I'm working up to a visit from the Maine Entomological Society. They're professionals. They're going to strain, sift, even suck insects from all the corners of my yard. I don't want to do any squealing when they're here. I heard about the society from Chuck Lubelchick. This is spelled Lubelczyk, who has begun trapping my mosquitoes to test them for West Nile virus. A rugged blonde biologist with Maine Medical Center's Vector-Borne Disease Lab, Chuck turned his attention to mosquitoes after the sudden arrival of West Nile. Last summer, 7 dead birds in Maine tested positive for the virus. This year, no one expects good news. I've given up the pretense that my interest in crows is scientific. I know each member of the family that shares my yard. They're loud, they're unruly, and they're mean to other birds, but they've become pets of a sort. My yard would be too quiet if they died. Initially, people didn't think West Nile was going to get up here. They thought Maine's too cold, Chuck says as he hangs a trap in my old crabapple tree one evening in early May. A sterling lizard is bolted to his earlobe. It'll be interesting to see how far north it can go. It's south as far as Florida now. It could get west to the Mississippi this year. In hindsight, this popular estimate misjudged the virus's mobility by half a continent. By autumn, crows will be falling into backyards from here to the Rockies. Well over 100 other species of bird, including hummingbirds, owls, eagles, herons, wild turkeys, and ducks, will test positive too. And by the time insect season withers, 284 people will be dead. Chuck's mosquito trap lures female mosquitoes with a combination of light and carbon dioxide. Then a 4-inch fan whisks them into a mesh bag. The fan is timed to let something as small as a mosquito get past, but moths, Chuck grimaces, moth puree. Or they get through and they thrash around and mess up the mosquitoes. Not every species of mosquito transmits West Nile, so the lab saves time by weeding out innocent species. But the identification of mosquito species sometimes come down to counting tiny body scales and hairs under the microscope. And if a moth has spattered its own scales or messier body parts on the skeeters, the night's trappings may be wasted. Before he leaves, Chuck sets an egg trap. This is a plastic tub of smelly water. One of the West Nile mosquitoes, Culex pipiens, prefers a putrid pool for its progeny, the sort of brew you might find in a stagnant bird bath or forgotten kiddie pool. The next morning, when he collects the traps, Chuck harvests both adults and eggs. Standing together like tiny missiles, 100 eggs makes up a black egg raft on the water. Left alone, each missile would release a larva into the pool. The fat-headed larva would grow large, eating microorganisms and tiny animals, including each other, should options run short. If you forget to feed a batch of mosquito larvae in the lab, Chuck muses, kneeling to dip the egg rafts into a vial, you end up with one large larva. A state lab will test my mosquitoes and eggs for virus. A diseased mosquito will bode ill for people, worse for crows. It will also darken my opinion of English sparrows. The sparrows share an ancestral home with West Nile virus, so they have some immunity to it. Unlike crows, who sicken and die quickly, a West Nile-infected English sparrow sits around with lots of virus in its blood for 5 days. Then its immune system may defeat the bug. During those 5 days, any mosquito that gnaws on the sparrow can tank up on the virus. An infected mosquito can stay infectious even as it overwinters in my attic. If a mosquito were to inject me with West Nile, I probably wouldn't notice. Fewer than 1% of people who get infected become seriously ill. The other 99% gain lifelong immunity. So I offer my arm to all passing mosquitoes. Crows are another story. In 2 different studies, every crow that was purposely infected with the virus died. In one of these studies, even uninfected crows in the same cage died of West Nile, having caught it directly from the purposely infected birds. This year, as the plague flutters and flaps westward, a sickened crow will fall on the White House lawn. Anecdotal reports from scientists will echo down the eastern seaboard. Crow numbers are crashing. A U.S. senator will wonder aloud whether the outbreak is the work of terrorists. Wildlife biologists will continue to gather new species of felled birds from backyards and deep woods. In Ohio, unofficial reports will suggest that upward of 100 owls died in 1 week. Raptors at nature centers and zoos will perish, and every time I can count 6 crows in the trees around my yard, I'll thank the mosquitoes for sparing them. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We are reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.